Hello and welcome to episode 37 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. In Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me, as usual, is Andrew Brokus. How's it going?
It's very good, and I'm coming to you today from Catonsville, Maryland, spending a day or two with my mother before I go visit my girlfriend in Austin and then return to Las Vegas triumphantly for the main event.
Hopefully not three main events, but maybe three main events.
Right? That's right. The plan is definitely the WSOP main event. Hopefully not the Caesars main event because it conflicts with day two of the WSOP main event. So things will not have gone well for me if I'm playing that one. And then also hopefully not the Venetian main event, which conflicts with something like day four, or day five of the main event. But in all honesty, that one's certainly more likely than the Caesars.
So even with this, this is a matter of some controversy. Even with the recent Sheldon Adelson article, you're still willing to play at the Venetian?
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel any kind of like ethical obligation to boycott the guy. I mean, I think it's just kind of a utility calculus. Like, obviously, I have personal and political disagreements with his stance, and I think he's a hypocrite and whatnot. But yeah, I don't think that like ethically obligates me to not play a tournament of which he will be like a some small beneficiary from the rake.
I just think I think he's in the wrong here, but I also think that if you were to list the 10 scummiest things that every major casino in Las Vegas did to protect their business, it's not clear to me that op-ed would be like more egregious than the rest of them.
Yeah, I would go a lot further than that. I would say it's probably not in the top 100.
Yeah, and although, yeah, I think there are a lot of ways to be in solidarity with the poker community other than boycotting. And it's so, and I don't think that he's done something like uniquely, if the Venetian were somehow uniquely supporting human trafficking or something like that, that would be one thing. But like, yeah, this thing is, I agree that it's like other things being equal, I certainly wouldn't mind if I made it through my trip to Vegas without setting foot in the Venetian. Like in other things equal, I probably will. But yeah, I don't think there's any really pressing reason to boycott.
Yeah, I would say online poker is just not an ethical issue for me.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you mean by not an ethical issue?
I mean, I don't think it's a matter of right and wrong. I don't think it's like, I don't feel like my freedoms are being obnoxiously trampled by the government because I'm not able to play right now. And I don't feel that it's not civil rights, right? It's not, it's not voting.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's absolutely a matter of right and wrong in a million different ways. I just think it's a complicated issue in that being against online poker is just not the worst thing somebody could be. Although all things considered, I think you ought not to be against online poker.
And your cat agrees with you.
Yeah. I don't know. I think the cat's with you. I think the cat's just really angry at Sheldon Adelson.
Hey, be quiet. I'm podcasting here.
Now, what's your WSOP plan? Are you just main event and then you're out?
A main event? Well, I've got like a whole trip plan. So I got the time that I'm like, it's explicitly okay for me to be away from the office, and I'm flying out on July 4th and I'm staying until a week from Saturday. And the main events is the only event I'm playing. There's some chance that if I were feeling absolutely spiffy and perfect, I would jump into the 1500 the day after I get there, but almost certainly not. And probably I'll just, play some cash games, meet some podcast listeners, get really geared up for the main. And yeah, I have a lot of reasons to want to just be at the absolute best for the main, not least because I think it's kind of fun to sort of teleologically organize my life around a poker tournament. Yeah. For a while. Like it's pretty cool to like give it your all. And it's not like more important than my family or anything during that time, but it is, I think it's a cool, interesting kind of thing to just try to do everything you can to win that tournament, like to perform at your absolute peak. So that's what I'll be doing.
What are you thinking in terms of day one?
Day one, I'm starting to be convinced by what you say. I'm starting to think that day one C is the thing to do, not least because being a working stiff, I now get up every morning at between 4 and 5 Las Vegas time, which is not when the main event starts. That's it. So,
you want to give yourself an extra day to get on that schedule.
And I guess day 1C is always bigger. The World Series is planning for it to be bigger because 1C funnels into its own day 2. 1A and 1B funnel into a single day 2, which makes me think that they're expecting more on day 1C, which probably means more of the sort of player I would like to play against.
Yeah.
I don't know. What are you thinking?
Well, my big problem with 1C is that you don't get a day off after day 2. And I consider that pretty significant. I mean, playing like 10 hours of poker, like WSOP quality poker against some of the best people in the world is pretty grueling. Like I appreciate the chance to rest afterwards, especially when I'm hoping to be playing for 3, 4, 5 days straight after that. I think it makes a pretty big difference if coming into day 5, or actually let's say coming into day 6, I think it makes a pretty big difference difference that I've been playing 3 days straight when someone else has been playing 4 days straight.
Yeah, that's fair. So which do you think that between 1A and 1B, one of the two is better?
Well, I'm going to be doing B just because I'm flying in on the 5th, which is the day before 1A, and I don't really want to play the day after I fly. I think I'm going to want to give myself a little bit of recovery and getting used to the Las Vegas time before I dive right into the main event. So I've kind of ruled out 1A. I was hoping, because you and I talked about this before, and you at that time were thinking 1B was going to be the best, and I felt good about that because that was the day that worked best for my schedule anyway. So it's pissing me off now that you're changing your tune.
You're just very persuasive, okay? Like I was totally convinced, and then you presented your reasons for 1C, and you know, if anything, I respond to reasons, right? So that's yeah. I mean, so that'll be a Saturday. Like I still think that the weekend days are going to be pretty good. I do like the thought of having a day off after day two if I make it through day two.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty big deal. I also think maybe we should try to plan some sort of meetup on, I guess it'll be the day of 1A.
Yes. If people have suggestions for a relatively quiet place that might not be too hard to get to, where a bunch of nits can get together and talk about things.
It can't be too expensive, naturally.
Yeah, it will not be a pure. So there will not be bottle service. Yeah, absolutely. And it's nice to see that people are wanting to get together, wanting to talk poker and meet us and drink some tea.
Look for an announcement about that on the next podcast. We'll give ourselves a deadline of setting something up by then and letting you know what's going on. So exciting episode we've got coming up today. We're going to be focusing on Pot Limit Omaha 8 or Better, which is one of my favorite games, and I think one of yours as well.
Yeah, I was a regular. This was my regular game for a very long time. And it was a while ago, so I'm a bit rusty, and I was probably having success at it at a time when the games were not as tough as they are now. But it's a game I spent a lot of time thinking about and had a fair amount of success at, and I really enjoy playing. So I actually didn't know it was one of your favorite games.
Yeah, I just think it's, well, I think there are a couple things that I like about it. One is I like that it's a big bet game. I mean, there are some other games that I enjoy playing. I like Triple Draw. I like Stud 8 or Better. But I don't know, big bet poker has always made more sense to me. I just get something about the logic of it and what you're trying to accomplish when playing it. I just feel like it resonates better with me. So I tend to prefer big bet games. And I like the split pot element of it because for people who don't know what they're doing, they can make pretty significant mistakes if they don't really know how to play a split pot game. And I also think there's some interesting elements in terms of hand reading and hand representation when there are two very different types of things that you could be going for. So unlike in high only game, or especially in a game like Raz where you can only be going low, I mean, hand reading is really, really straightforward in Raz, so much so that I feel like most people can do it. Like it's kind of hard to have an edge on hand reading in Raz because there's really no confusion about what you're drawing for. I mean, there's
unless you're a super expert.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it's not possible for people to be deceptive. I just think it's a lot easier for it's a lot easier for that edge to be equaled out across players because in Raz you're only trying to make one thing. Right. I mean, even in Hold'em, it's like, well, is he drawing at a flush? Is he drawing at a straight? Does he already have two pair? I mean, in Raz there's only one hand that you can make. The split pot games, there's so many more possibilities. I mean, there's all those different possible high hands, plus there's the element of low draw. So there's just more that someone could be drawing at. And I think that can present more opportunities to read their hand. It can present more opportunities to conceal your own hand. I just think that this is kind of the part of poker that I'm best at, the deductive reasoning and the logic, trying to figure out your opponent's logic, trying to confound the logic that he's using to read your hand. I just feel like that's what I excel at the most in poker. And I think PLO 8 really emphasizes that maybe more than any other game.
It's nice also because to play in a tournament setting, because it's a game that changes drastically between deep, medium, and short stack poker, like even a lot more than other games, I think.
Yeah.
So if you're a poker player and not like a cookbook follower, there's a lot in a PLO 8 tournament for you, I think.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that I enjoy. And this is also why I enjoy ante-only tournaments. Is it anytime there's a need for that kind of adaptation, or there's fewer opportunities to play a cookie cutter strategy? You know, especially now, I'm not a high value player. I mean, I'm not going to put in. I mean, there are people who are playing 2-3 million hands of no limit hold'em in a year, and I'm not going to be one of those people. So when it comes to just kind of like rote mastering a set strategy and not thinking too creatively, that's not my forte, and I want to have the edge of being able to think creatively because I think that I understand a lot of like poker fundamentals better than players like that do, but it can be difficult to overcome that kind of experiential advantage. And they may have just trial and error their way to a pretty good strategy. So I think anything that takes people out of their comfort zone a bit, and I don't think there's anyone who has that much PLO8 experience for one thing. And then secondly, as you say, I think that the situations change more than they do in a game like No Limit Hold'em as you move from deeper to shallower stacks. And I think that, you know, forcing people to make those kinds of on-the-fly adaptations and figure out situations in the moment rather than just have a learned strategy for dealing with, you know, common situations that might encompass 99% of what you're going to encounter at the table. I think that's another thing that privileges my skills over the skills of my competition.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other reason that we're talking PLO8 today is that I made a pretty deep run in the $1,500 PLO8 event at the WSOP. Ended up finishing 16th out of a field of nearly 1,000. I don't remember the exact number of players, but that was pretty exciting considering that I really don't know. I mean, I've played the game a bit over the years, and I'm certainly familiar with rules and basic strategy, but I'm by no means a high volume PLO8 player. So it was pretty exciting in a lot of ways to go deep in that tournament, because I felt like I was really experiencing a lot of things for the first time. And just like what I was just talking about, figuring out a lot of situations on the fly, there were just a ton of opportunities to do that. And that was a lot of fun, in addition to the excitement of, you know, being down to the final two tables of a WSOP tournament.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to sweat you also, just because
it was very helpful to be sweated by you.
Yeah, here you are making a deep run in one of my favorite games. And yeah, it was fun. You see, you were playing with Barry Greenstein and Alan Cunningham and a bunch of other good players there at the end. So
yeah, and yeah. I got a good real life rail as well. Sylvain dropped by to sweat me. We've read a couple of his emails, or at least one of his emails, on the show before.
Yes.
So he stopped by to say hello, and shout out to him also. He finished 5th in a $1,000 Venetian deep stack event while he was in Vegas. Fantastic accomplishment on his part.
Yeah, that's one of my second favorite Twitter rail of the last 2 weeks. So well done, Sylvain. And hey, I guess he was sick for his flight, but he seems to have gotten back okay, so that's good.
And Leo Wolpert stopped by to give me a thumbs up as well. So very cool to have that support, both virtual and in the flesh on the rail.
Yeah. So let's talk about some hands, huh?
Yeah, and even before we get into that, I think maybe we should. Well, first off, I mean, I just want to take a second in case there are people out there who don't know the rules of PLO8. This is, you know, it's a variant of Pot Limit Omaha, so you're dealt four cards. There's going to be 5 community cards, just like there are in Hold'em, and you're going to have to use exactly 2 of the cards in your hand in making your final 5 card hand. So not more than 2, not fewer than 2. And in this game, the pot is split between the high hand and the low hand. If the low hand is, this is where the 8 or better comes from, if the low hand is better than an 8. So the best possible low hand is ace, 2, 3, 4, 5. Straights do not count against you as they do in some low games. And the worst possible low hand is 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. So if your hand has a 9 in it, then or if there aren't 3 cards lower than a 9 on the board, then there's not going to be a low hand, period. And you don't have to use the same 2 cards. So you're gonna use 2 cards from your hand plus 3 from the community cards to make a high hand, and also 2 cards from your hand plus 3 from the community cards to make a low hand. And then if you have the best high hand, you'll get half the pot. And if you have the best low hand at showdown, then you will get half the pot. So basic strategy for PLO8 first. I mean, I think the generic information that you're going to get if you were to go out and Google PLO8 strategy is going to be about the importance of playing to scoop, meaning playing to make both a high and a low. Especially when you're deep stacked, it's a pretty expensive mistake. You know, if you, for instance, if you have ace deuce and you flop the nut low, but you have virtually no chance of making the high. I mean, in a kind of a worst case scenario, maybe you have like ace deuce 9-10 and the board is 5-6-7. Well, then you'd have a gut shot. Ace deuce 10 jack you have, and the board is 5-6-7 king. I mean, you've got half the pot, but if you have an opponent who's, you know, constantly betting big into you, there's a very good chance that he also has ace deuce and that he's going to beat you in the high end of the pot. So you're going to win just a quarter of the pot at the end of the day, and that's a bad situation to be in.
Yeah, and the way that this usually plays out in terms of actual tactical adjustment is in 2 ways. One is pre-flop, getting yourself out of the quartering situations by not playing one-way hands. And second, in multi-way pots, So in the heads up scenario you describe, oftentimes you have to call down just because there's such a good chance that you're going to get half instead of a quarter. And oftentimes they're not betting the full pot. So you only have to get half the pot, whatever, 1/8 of the time in order to justify the call. Where you can really fold your hand is in a multi-way pot where it becomes very clear that another person has ace deuce and that you're only going to get a quarter and that you're going to get whipsawed for other big bets. So yeah, the thing to do is, you know, you really look for places to fold in multi-way pots and in those rare situations where it's almost a lock that you're getting quartered in heads-up pots, and then also by just folding hands like ace-deuce 7-9 in early position. You know, you do have the ace-deuce draw, but, you know, especially if you don't have suitedness or if you're only, like, say, suited to the 7 or something like that, you just fold, especially if you're in an aggressive game. You know, the risk reward just is not there because you're not going to get more than half the pot very often, and it's going to be expensive just to find out if you actually get half the pot.
Yeah, and this is one of the interesting things about PLOA is that even when we're talking about starting hands, it's not nearly as static as it is in No Limit, where you can just say in No Limit, like, these are the class A hands and these are the class B hands and these are the class C hands and your pocket
top queens. 10 hands. So, yeah, but there aren't really like a top 10. I mean, I guess maybe there are top 10 hands in PLOA, but it's all very situational.
Yes, I mean, like, it's certainly very good to begin with an ace deuce, and a lot of the best hands that you could be dealt in PLOA are going to have ace deuce in them. But you know, whether or not you're going to play, you know, ace deuce jack is going to depend a lot on the situation. Like any given ace deuce hand, whether or not you're going to play it will be a lot more situational, and that becomes even more true of other types of hands. So, you know, this is one thing I think that both No Limit players and PLO players tend to make some mistakes in PLO8. That No Limit players will tend to overvalue a hand like king 5-7, where they're like, oh, I have a pair of kings and I have a low draw, so I have a pretty good hand. Yeah. And in fact, neither of those is a very good hand. I mean, 7-5 is extremely difficult to make a good low with 7-5. Most of the times you do make a low that's worth anything at all with 7-5. It's when there's an ace on the board, because most of your opponents are playing to make ace lows. So they're playing hands like ace deuce, ace three. So the best chance for your 7-5 to play as a low is when there's an ace on the board. And of course, that's the time when your pocket kings are worth the least, because now there's an overcard to your pair. So I mean, those pocket, and especially if you don't have any kind of low draw at all, so king 9-8 is an even worse hand. But I think a lot of hold'em players tend to overvalue those big pairs, particularly in situations where they're pretty likely to be getting an all in and called pre flop. Those hands really don't perform that well when you're getting all in pre. I think a lot of PLO players also tend to overvalue some different types of high only hands. So they'll look at a hand like King Queen Jack 10 and
wraps and rundowns.
Yeah, I mean, and those can be decent hands in PLO8, but it's extremely situational as to whether or not they are good. In my opinion, anyway, they tend to be most useful in multi way pots where you can see a flop cheaply and hope that it comes out high cards. I mean, if the board does come high, you have an extremely strong hand. If it comes low, then you're probably not going to be playing your hand, even if you flop decently well. I mean, if the flop is like if the flop is like ace deuce king and you're holding ace king queen jack, you've got top two, but depending on how the board plays out, that may not turn out to be that strong of a hand. And you know, especially in a multi-way pot where there's a lot of action, the fact that you don't have a low draw is going to hurt you pretty badly. So that's the sort of hand that you may be getting away from, even though it seems like a pretty strong hand.
Yeah, you want to be playing those high only hands in late position. It just makes it so much easier to know where you are and to make your opponent fear that you have the hand that you actually fear. So yeah, it's just, you know, those one-way hands can be actually quite profitable if played sort of speculatively from late position, just because a one-way hand doesn't mean it's not a scooping hand. You don't have to have a two-way hand to scoop. You can have a one-way hand if no low comes, right? But yeah, trying to play them out of position, trying to get to showdown and win and make some money off of it, it's just not a winning battle a lot of the time. I mean, if you're at a very passive table, then sure, limp king, queen, jack under the gun. Or if it's tight, then raise. Then you have some semi-bluff equity pre-flop going on. But for the most part, those hands play a lot better in late position.
Yeah. So one of the things I like about PLO8, and you can see how difficult we're having, or how much difficulty I anyway am having coming up with specific examples for some of this stuff, is that it is a lot more situational, and there aren't as many just like real common situations that occur over and over again that you're going to be super familiar with. But one point that I want to make about PLO8 tournaments is that I think that playing to scoop bit is a little overrated, and I'm not going to say it's not important, but the play to scoop thing is a lot more important when you're really deep, because the possibility of getting in like 100 big blinds and getting quartered on it is that's a pretty big problem. When you're only starting the hand with 20 or 30 big blinds in the first place, you're a little less concerned about getting the rest of your stack in kind of bad, and you're more concerned about maximizing your equity on the money that's already in the pot. I mean, what's already in the pot and getting your share, more than your share of it, is a lot more important when you're shallow than when you're deep, just because it's a larger fraction of the money that you're risking in order to get that. So I think that there are some circumstances where you might shove as a kind of semi-bluff when you're shallow with hands that you might fold when you're deep.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's just coming down to the fact that you're playing a tournament. And the whole point of tournaments just are attempts to win a lot of pots. Like, that's just the whole game. I'm exaggerating, but you know, whether it's PLO8 or Super Raz Doogie or whatever they're playing at the Aria these days. Have you heard about these new games like Super Stud? And it's no, crazy stuff. You like roll your own, you get dealt four cards and you throw one away, then you roll your own or something. Or I'm getting this slightly wrong, but a lot of the highest action is now crazier stud variants that involve either rolling your own or discarding, or the bring in getting to roll its own after a while. So anyway, there's like Super Stud and Super Raz Doogie. Anyway, even if you were playing those things in a tournament, still the whole thing you would be trying to do is win pots. It's a struggle for the antsies. It's like Slansky said about poker. It's a struggle for the antsies, and it's never truer than in tournament poker. I guess he meant something slightly different when he said that, but the point is that
and I think that's one advantage that I might have. In general, I'm pretty intimidated in a tournament like this when I run into someone who really is a mixed games expert, and I did, as you mentioned, like, you know, obviously Barry Greenstein or Noun Cunningham have a lot more experience than I do playing all kinds of non-hold'em games, including PLO8. And actually, those particular guys, I probably don't have an edge in terms of tournament strategy either. But I think there are some players who aren't really tournament players, who are more like they're mixed game specialists, and they will understandably jump into the non-hold'em WSOP events because they have a pretty big edge in terms of their understanding of those games. But I do think sometimes they don't fully get tournament strategy or get the importance of what we were just talking about. And if you don't know how to adapt your basic approach to PLO8 to playing in a short stacked environment, I think you're also going to make some pretty significant mistakes there.
So I think we should talk about some hands now.
Yeah, I agree. Today is going to be pretty much a pure strategy episode, so before we get into it, I want to remind you that Tournament Poker Edge is the place to go for tournament poker strategy. If you're looking specifically for non-hold'em strategy, there's a very well-reviewed series by Halo Wax on playing PLO MTTs. To be honest though, a lot of what helped me succeed in this PLO8 WSOP event that we're about to discuss was just having a good understanding of the fundamentals of tournament poker, and the TPE theory videos are a great way to learn that. You can find theory videos on Tournament Poker Edge from Ben Warrington, Daryl Jace, Kevin Dirksen, Chris Moon, myself of course, you know I love theory, and from many others. You can get all that and more by signing up for tournamentpokeredge.com.
So Andrew kindly provided on the agenda five hands from increasingly far into the tournament, and we'll say a little more about some of these than others, but it'll give you a nice progression. How about that?
Okay, that sounds good to me. So yeah, we're going to start off actually somewhat deep into the tournament already at the 300-600 level. So yeah, we're going to be somewhat shallow in all of these hands. To be honest, I was kind of card dead during the deep portions of the tournament, so I didn't play a lot of hands for that reason. B, I don't think I was necessarily playing that well during that phase. I was still maybe finding my sea legs a little bit. And C was never really got all that deep because the way this tournament was structured, instead of giving you 4,500 starting chips as you would generally get in a 1,500-hour tournament, you got 1,500 chips plus two add-on chips that are worth 1,500 each, and you have an option of when you wanted to redeem those. I was more confident in my ability to play shallow stacked than deep stacked, and I wanted to give myself the best chance of surviving in the tournament, partly just because I wanted to enjoy playing it. So I did not cash in my add-on chips until I was pretty short, which means I was never playing especially deep to begin with.
Yeah.
So these hands are starting. The first of these hands comes from the 300-600 level. In this hand, I open up ace, king, king, three with a single suit to the ace. I open with that hand in early position. And this is a hand, I mean, I know I was talking before about people sometimes overvalue pocket kings. It's a hand that goes up considerably in value when you have a good low draw going along with it. So I've got ace three, which is the second best, you know, starting low hand. Obviously, it'll depend somewhat what the board looks like in terms of how good of a low hand it is after the flop. But next to ace deuce, ace three is going to be the best possible low starting combination. So it's nice that I have a more high-powered low. And also having an ace in my hand helps me a lot. In, you know, it's less likely that an ace is going to flop too. And even if an ace does flop, I'm going to have top pair, top kicker. So that greatly increases the value of playing my pocket kings as an overpair after the flop.
Yes.
So I open to 1600 in early position. The player on my immediate left calls and everyone else folds.
Any reads on that guy?
No.
Okay.
The effective stacks are 18K. And there is 4,100 in the pot when we see the flop. So we're looking at something like a 4.5 to 1 stacked pot ratio. The flop comes 866 with a backdoor nut flush draw for me. I believe it was 866 rainbow. So there aren't any flush draws on the flop, but I do have a backdoor flush draw. First question is, are you betting this flop? And if so, how much?
I think this is heavily opponent dependent. I think this can be a nice flop to balance out your checking range with. So you're going to whiff this flop, not whiff this flop, but you're going to have, say, ace, king, queen, deuce sometimes on this flop. And I guess that's a hand you won't mind bet folding all that much, but you would also maybe like to check and see a free turn with that hand sometimes. It would also, I think this is a nice hand to put in your checking range for a few reasons. First is that it strengthens up your checking range on the high end a little bit. And it also, you know, lets you can check and call a bet pretty comfortably equity wise. You got some low stuff going on. You have an emergency high. Well, not an emergency high. Your kings will be good sometimes, though it may be hard to get to the river with it. And I just think, you know, especially because you can also, a lot of people have bet sizing issues in this game where half pot and full pot mean very different things. I like this hand as a check evaluate hand, both for exploitive and for balancing reasons.
Yeah, I wish that I had
checked.
The other problem with betting is that I think maybe even more so in a PLO8 tournament where a lot of people are playing in a kind of simplistic way. Like, I don't know that even in a cash game, just raising pot if you have a bear ace deuce would be such a bad idea here. If you had like ace deuce 5-4 for, you know, the nut low draw on a gut shot or, you know, something like that. Like, you don't have too much of a high and you mostly just have a bear ace deuce. I don't know that, you know, jamming it would be that bad, but I think even more so in tournaments where people are really not comfortable with their post-flop play and are just kind of looking to put a lot of money in the pot when they like their hand and think they have some fold equity. I think there's a very good chance that someone holding ace deuce, even if they don't have much to go along with it, is going to raise rather than call when you bet.
Okay.
And I think that's kind of bad for me.
And if that's the case, then if you bet, you're a little bit tied to the pot because you've got a low draw. You have a pair of kings that's going to be better than the other guy's high sometimes. You know, sometimes, yeah, you're going to run into ace, deuce, 4 or 5. Yeah, you know, like you said, or, you know, ace, deuce, deuce, queen, or a hand like that. That said, ran the odds here. You're in, yeah, you're down to like 16% against a hand with ace, deuce, six in it. You've got a little more than a third of the equity against a worse hand with a six. Like, so a hand with a six and a worse low draw than yours is something like a 62-38 favorite against you. I mean, depending on details. And, you know, so if you include some of those ace, deuce, XX, and especially hands like ace, queen, queen, seven, or something like that, that might also jam it against you, then you're almost pot stuck after you bet, but that sucks. So then checking starts to look pretty good again. all in all, I'd say this is a crappy spot.
Yeah, I mean, you have a hand that you're a lot more comfortable bluff catching with in a small pot than a big pot, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether you check and he bets or whether you bet and he raises, you're kind of going to be bluff catching, but he's going to be bluffing a hell of a lot more often when you check. And he's also going to be possibly trying to value bet hands worse than yours when you check, like the ace, queen, queen, seven or something. A lot more so than he's going to pot it, I think, if you bet into him. So I think checking calling would have been a better idea. I may have made the worst possible decision here in that I bet 2,500 and folded when he raised pot.
Yeah, I mean, given... when I read this hand on the agenda, I thought that you had to fold, even though, especially with tournament considerations and the fact that despite what I think is an error of this hand, I think you should have a playing edge. I do think a good number of your opponents are not racing here without a six or without, you know, ace, deuce, five, seven or something else like that. And I think against the whole range of hands, you're probably not getting your price and you would like to survive in the tournament. So I do, if you teleported me to that situation right now, I think I would fold. Our next hand comes from the 800-1600 blind level. What happened there?
Quite a jump here. We're now on day two. We're in the money. I don't want to say that nothing interesting happened between now and then, but this is the next one that I found interesting to specifically for the purpose of discussing with you. So this one now is against Doc Sands, who is, of course, an extremely accomplished tournament player. I don't know that he has that much PLO8 experience specifically.
It won't stop him from tanking every hand and slowing up the game for everybody because he thinks he can gain a slight advantage, right?
I will say I didn't have a big problem with that while I was playing with him. I know that he does have that reputation, but it did not seem egregious to me. That said, someone did complain at me on Twitter for taking a long time while he was at the table with me, so maybe I'm not the best judge of these things.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody's at a table with you and Doc Sands and they're complaining about you taking too long...
He was not at that same table.
Okay. That's not as bad. I have no problem saying that we should all just collectively try to shame Doc Sands into stopping doing that because it's bullshit and it's bad for everybody and it's just an obvious collective action problem. Doc Sands, if you're listening, I mean, eventually you guys will just have to change the rules so that you can't just sit and wait 10 seconds every hand. Anyway, Doc Sands raises to 3,200 from the cutoff.
Yeah, and I think he's probably going to play this somewhat the way he would a no-limit tournament, which is to say, you know, be attacking blinds from late position, continuation betting, not wanting to give up pots in cases where he thinks that you probably don't have anything. Like, I mean, I think that's a pretty standard, like, elite no-limit tournament player sort of mentality, is just, like, try to win every pot where neither player has a great hand.
You're not just flattering me because I just went on this whole thing about how you should try to win a lot of pots in tournaments, and that's like all of tournament poker, right?
I think that's true.
Yeah, okay.
So he opens 3,200 from the cutoff. He has 32K behind. I have 50K. I have ace, eight, three, deuce with nut spades in my big blind. Is this one you think I should re-raise him and be ready to get it in pre-flop?
I'd rather call. If your hand had a little more floppability, like even a hand that's in some ways worse, like if you're going to put the pressure on, I might re-raise a hand like even an absolutely worse hand like ace, jack, nine, deuce that's going to be able to pop a lot of flops and, you know, in a relatively okay way. Then you can represent like you had aces. You know, a lot of people will be playing exactly over that pairs that hard, and you aren't going to flat out miss a lot of boards. Like, it's pretty hard to construct boards that you just flat out whiff with like ace, jack, nine, deuce. So if you're looking to ramp up the pressure pre-flop, I'd rather do it with a hand like that. And you have a suit here. You have ABC, not just ace, deuce. You know, glossary, ABC means ace, deuce, three in a low game, in case our listeners don't know that. But, you know, you've got a protected low draw, in fact, four low cards. You've got a suited ace. You know, this hand's just going to play well.
I realized I don't actually have a suited ace. I have the ace of spades, and I have clubs to the eight.
I actually suspected that because if your hand was suited in spades, I was going to throw up in my garbage can when I found out how this hand ended.
I think it's going to become significant when you see the flop that I have a blocker to the nut flush draw, but I do not have the nut flush draw. I made a mistake in writing up this hand example in the notes that I are looking at now.
Okay, well, then I like calling even more, I think. I like your hand for a min raise, and although attacking players who are attacking blinds is good, I don't think this is the right hand to be doing it with, and especially not against somebody who's not going to be scared money. Yeah, I doubt that Doc Sands is all that worried about squeaking up another orbit, you know.
Yeah, in fact, not that he was playing badly, but he was talking about being disappointed that he was going to be missing, I think it was the 5K Stix Max was starting in this evening. So I don't think he would have been heartbroken to bust this tournament and go play the 5K Stix Max.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't, he wasn't, he certainly wasn't pitching.
Yeah, by the way, about the min raise, and I could talk about this for a long time, and Andrew and I did talk about this for a long time, but if min raises are taking down the blinds, great, but I think that from a theoretical standpoint, you want to be raising a little bit more in PLOA just because it's not that hard to play out of position when the stacks aren't that deep for one more big blind. There are just a lot of hands that you can navigate pretty safely, but that's a whole different thing. And we might have a long talk about that later. I think it's worth one blind, and you should call here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm clearly not folding. I've an extremely pretty hand. It's I think kind of to boil down the argument for calling versus re-raising. It's that my hand is pretty flop dependent in the sense that there are going to be certain flops where my hand is just toast, and it sucks to like re-raise here and get called and have the flop come king queen jack.
Yeah, that's right. Although, if you do get 32K in, it's going to be really hard to be in that bad of shape. Yeah, sure, he's going to have aces sometimes, but you've got four low cards.
I mean, or if I just, like, pot it and he calls.
Yeah.
And then there's, like, 20K in the pot and 20K in the stacks. And then I get a really nasty flop or something. I mean, I think there's just kind of some gross cases like that.
Although, the ones that are gross for you are gross for his range, too. Like, especially if you're sizing your bets properly. If you do re-raise and it comes down king, queen, jack, then just bet a third of the pot and fold, you know? Because, like, you're going to hit that board sometimes, and he's going to whiff it a lot also, and he's not going to see a bluff spot in, you know, so if the SPR is one and you bet one third of the pot, like, he's not going to really perceive a bluffing opportunity by jamming it in, I don't think. So, you know, I actually think that there aren't that many bad playing situations for you if you re-raise, especially if you aren't re-raising the full pot. You know, there are bad flops for your hand, but there aren't that many bad flops for your situation against a late position raiser, if that makes sense.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So the flop comes queen 7-4 with two spades, which again, I do not have nut spades. I do have the ace of spades, but I don't have another spade to go with it. So the one bit of information I do have is that Doc does not have nut spades.
Okay.
And so this is a pretty dry flop in the sense that it's unlikely that anyone has a very strong high hand.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of playable hands that include both a queen and a seven or both a queen and a four. I mean, and I'm not saying there are none, like ace, deuce, queen, four is a very playable hand, but you know, queen four, queen seven is a much less likely two pair combination than queen jack is, and less likely than seven sixes. There are only so many ways that someone's going to make a set. There are no straights possible. I know that he doesn't have the nut flush draw. It's just, it's not that likely that he's really smacked this board hard. You know, and I obviously have not smacked the board hard. I have a nut low draw with some counterfeit protection, which is nice. I don't have much to speak of in terms of a high, I don't even have draws to good high hands, so I don't have a lot in the way of a high hand, but you know, I also have reason to think that he's probably not hitting this board terribly well all that often either.
Yeah, I think that's right, but it's also not that hard to make one pair, so you know, in these blind battle situations, like, it's pretty, everything you just said is pretty clear, and so even a hand like ace, king, seven, deuce, like, I would perceive that as a hand with serious high value
in
the situation. Yeah, and it's just not that hard to make one pair.
Right.
When, I mean, he has four cards after all, right? And especially with, you know, 5-6 makes an open-end straight draw, then there are a lot of gut shots also. So, especially given that overcards will be good sometimes, you know, like ace, king, three, deuce or something is, well, no, ace, king, 5-3, you know, that's, I perceive that as a hand with some high value. And I mean, that then you're starting to get into like very little high value. So although everything you said about it's like hard to crush that flop, I'm not sure how relevant that is from a playing perspective against a good player.
Interesting. So I was wondering whether maybe I should, whether I should bet here with the intention of possibly jamming over a raise, especially if he doesn't raise pot. I think there might be a case for three bet jamming with the thought that a small bet might induce a bluff raise from him.
Yeah, I don't like that. I mean, I like the thought. I like the thought that, you know, you're using your poker chops well here. You're like, okay, he might bluff raise and I might catch him bluffing and re-raise him. Problem is, like, what happens after that? I mean, what happens after that is, unfortunately, him saying like, well, I don't know where my equity is, but I probably have enough equity to call, so I call, even if he does bluff raise. Like, it's almost hard for him to have a pure, if he happens to have king 996 that he was on a pure steal with, then he might raise fold that. But if he decides that raising is all things considered better with king, queen, 5-3, so if it goes bet, raise, and then you jam, like, what's he going to do? Fold with one pair and a gut shot and an emergency low draw? Like, no. I mean, I don't think so. He's going to feel gross about calling it off.
Well, my equity is not so bad against the king, queen, 5-3, though.
Yeah, but then, like, when you think about his raise calling range, so, like, all his ace, deuce, seven hands, I think, well, maybe not all of them, but I can see a lot of reasons to raise with something like an ace deuce seven hand or an ace deuce queen hand, you know, ace queen 4-3 or something. You know, it's that I like your thinking. I just don't think the math is going to work out if we look at the whole range. Absolutely. Yeah. So you check folded here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can see the reasoning for that. And this is something where it's so player dependent that I'll confess I don't know a lot of the theory behind it. Against a lot of people, you can actually check call because they're gonna check behind too many turns, and you're gonna, you know, given two shots at the turn and river, you're gonna, especially since you have ABC instead of just ace deuce, you're going to make the nut low by the river, and you're probably only gonna face one bet most of the time that you've got to call. And then sometimes goofy things happen and you spike one pair and that's good for the high. So that's fine. And you said that betting's maybe an option. And yeah, that's interesting. Like, if you bet out, he might be the sort of player, if he has nothing, he's just going to fold. But his nothing might actually have a good amount of equity. So that's also more player dependent, but I like your thought there. Okay, so my thought is check folding against a good aggressive player is probably best, but feels a bit icky. In a lot of the games that I used to play, I used to be able to get away with check calling. If I had some reason to believe that somebody was going to be scared, then I like betting, because then you can go bet. Like, if the person doesn't have a nut low, then if you bet and hit your low, you can just pot it again and get them off a lot of high hands.
That was one of the scenarios that I like the best about betting. Is I think it enables me to play the turn a lot better than if I check call. If we were to rule out check folding, would you like betting better than check calling?
Yes. Although, again, very, very, very opponent dependent.
So I ended up check folding, so that's about all I have to say about that hand. Any last comments there?
Nah, on to 1K, 2K.
All right. So at the 1K, 2K level, I'm in the cutoff with ace, jack, jack, eight, and nut clubs. Figure that's a hand worth an open from that position.
Yeah, cutoff. Yeah, sure. Why not?
No, probably a fold under the gun, though, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So this is one that
I want to highlight. Hand looks ugly. By the way, this hand looks ugly to me. Ace, jack, jack, eight. It's not a good hand.
Right. And I want to highlight this because I think for a lot of your no limit players who are waiting into PLO8, this might look like a pretty hand where you're like, well, I've got a decent overpair, which you don't. Pocket jack's not a decent overpair, but you might say to yourself, well, I've got a decent overpair because jacks are a good hand and no limit. But, you know, Nate and Andrew said, don't overvalue your overpairs, make sure you've got something else to go with it. But look, I've got a low draw, I've got an ace, I've got nut clubs, I've got plenty to go with it.
Yeah.
And the problem is just none of that is good enough. Like, if you flop top set, you're in pretty good shape, although not necessarily great shape, especially if there's a low draw out there. Ace-8 is not a very good low to be drawing at. I mean, most of the times that you get action, someone else is drawing at a better low, and you kind of have to hope that they get counterfeited for your ace-8 to play. You know, flopping a pair of aces with a jack kicker is not that helpful to you. Again, like, there's a pretty good chance your opponent is going to have a two pair or an ace with a better kicker.
And you can't really improve because, yeah, you just don't have a live hand to improve very often if you hit one pair.
Yep. So this is not a hand that has a lot of playability, but from late position where you think you've got a decent chance of stealing the blinds and where you're going to be in position post flop, then I think it's well worth an open.
Especially, I mean, I don't know what the stacks were behind you, but even ugly hands with an ace in them do okay hot and cold for, you know, up to 10 or whatever big blinds. So even this sort of stinking pile of trash of a hand, ace, jack, jack, eight, I mean, it is good enough to have decent hot and cold equity. So if somebody has 11 big blinds behind you and repots you, as long as your life isn't immediately on the line there, you can just get it in and hope for the best, even though you have a stinking pile of trash.
Yeah, we're not that shallow. I'm starting the hand with 60K, and he has me covered. So, we're looking at like 30 big blind stacks.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, at the point where you open, there are three people behind you, though, so...
Yeah, that's true. But the player in the big blind who is the one most likely to play with me, you know, he has me covered. I have 60K, which is, you know, I'm certainly not more deep than 30 big blinds.
All right.
I don't remember how I compared to everyone else behind me. So I opened to just 4K, which I know we talked about the min raising thing. I'm somewhat more likely to do that in late position than in early position. That might be a holdover from hold them. But and the min races were getting more folds than they should. I'll say that much. I min race and I get called by both the button and the big blind. The flop comes king, king, seven with two clubs, which means that I have flopped, you know, I've got a pair of jacks for my current high, and I also have a nut flush draw. I have a backdoor low draw, although it's not a very good one. So right now we're looking at 13K in the pot and 56K in my stack, so like 3.5 to 1 SPR.
Yeah.
What are you looking to do here?
I'd like to win the pot. I'd like to not put that much money in the pot to win it. And I would like to make a good value bet if the time arises for it. That's what I would like to do in this hand. I would also really like to know my opponent before I went into this hand. Your hand figures to be best a lot of the time. King, king, seven. So you've got the best flush draw, and you have the pair of jacks, where if he had aces, he probably would have re-raised you pre-flop. Even some queens hands are going to re-raise you before the flop, correctly or incorrectly. So I think you're going to be best here a lot. I do think that there's some reason to check behind. You risk a low draw coming if that happens.
Well, but I'm not entirely checking behind because the button is still live. Yeah, if I had the opportunity to take a free card, there's a good chance I would have done that. I think having the button live changes things a little bit.
Yeah, all things considered, I would probably bet about half the pot here, which is what you did.
Yeah, that's about what I did. I bet 7,500. I think I'm not too likely to get raised without a king here. You know, unlike the previous instance where we saw me bet fold a paired board, there aren't really draws that I'm worried about my opponent semi-bluffing. I mean, no one can have a low draw right now. I have the nut flush draw, so I'm not worried about someone, you know, just potting me with that. There's an outside chance someone's going to overvalue a non-nut flush draw and raise, but I think that's kind of unlikely. So if I get raised, I think it's either going to be a kind of advanced play where someone realizes that this might be a good board to attack a continuation bet. You know, there aren't a ton of these spots to just make a pure bluff in PLO8 because of how easy it is for someone to have some piece of the board. But this potentially is one of them. I mean, this is a tough board to hit precisely for the reasons I just gave, that you know, there's not a low out there. And unless you have a king in your hand, you don't have a strong high. And even in PLO, it's somewhat difficult to flop trips. So especially in a heads-up pot, I think you will sometimes see bluff raises on this board, somewhat less likely in a multi-way pot. And I'm not necessarily playing against opponents advanced enough to do that anyway.
Yeah.
So I think there's a pretty good chance I'm not going to get raised unless someone has a king. And my high is pretty vulnerable right now. I mean, ace is as I was emphasizing before, you're making a pair of aces with this hand is not necessarily great. Although I guess in this board, the kings provide me protection from, like, if someone doesn't have a king and I hit an ace, my jack kicker is going to be pretty decent.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure. I mean, I understand everything you said, but especially if you're playing against hold'em players, like, everybody can see that this flop is dry-ish, at least, and everybody can see that you're pretty likely to have nothing. I'm not so sure you're immune from a bluff raise here, actually.
Okay.
That said, I mean, that's a pretty game flowy thing, but if people know how to bluff in multi-way pots, it's going to be here. Like, everybody knows a raise looks pretty scary, and, like, that you're pretty likely not to have better than one pair here, mm-hmm. So... Yeah, especially if you do bet half the pot, it looks like you want folds, which you almost always do. So
and which I did here, even though I'm not really making better hands fold, I still think that my hand is vulnerable enough. And this happens a lot more in PLO8, like, because hand equities run closer together, even when you have the best hand, there's a lot more value than there is in hold'em in just getting your opponents to fold and to take the pot now. So I mean, I just decided to go kind of a straightforward strategy. I just bet 7,000. I'm pretty sure in a heads up pot I would have checked behind here, but I bet 7,000 and the button raised to 15.5.
Yeah, this hand folded. Yeah, this sucks. This really sucks.
It's a nasty spot to be in because you really don't want to be drawing in a nut flush when there's a pair on the board if you think there's a significant chance your opponent has it. So, I mean, determining the likelihood that he's bluffing here is pretty important, and I don't really know how to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think folding is fine if you think that the person's straightforward. In practice, I don't mind calling him once and then evaluating, just because you would probably do that with a lot of your really strong hands. And maybe not, actually. If you had a really strong hand, you might just jam it in to keep him from picking up a low draw. But I think your call will be perceived as pretty strong here. And although in a tournament it really sucks to put in 15-5 on this flop and then check fold later, I think now that you're in that situation, and again, this could just be my experience against weaker, more passive players, but I do think there's an argument for calling.
Okay. Because, you know, my MO for this tournament was really just not wanting to get into murky situations. you know, I didn't have as much confidence as I do. Even in No Limit, I should probably avoid them more than I do. But I didn't have as much confidence in my hand reading and decision making abilities in this game as I did in No Limit. And I really wanted to kind of try to fold while the pot was still smallish if I was not going to know what to do on future streets. So yeah. I elected just to lay this one down.
Okay, that's fair enough. I know that in my spot on the button, like, so imagine you're the button with ace, deuce, four, jack. And you called, and the big blind came along, and the big blind checked, so then the preflop raiser bets 7,000.
Sure, not look, more I get the case for bluff raising. I mean, it's yeah. more just a question of whether I'm giving my opponents credit for being able to do it, and maybe I'm not giving them enough credit.
But I mean, I'm just saying, like, it's a tournament. Like, everybody wants to win the tournament, and it's not like he's 12-tabling and he's just click fold. Like, I mean, he's in that situation. Like, he can't help but think, you know? Like, I mean, like in that spot, like, I know I would have a hard time not bluff raising with every. I mean, it's just. I mean, the situation is just screaming out. I mean, like the chips that you put in the pot are just like anthropomorphically calling to him to be taken away from you. You know, at least sometimes. I don't know. So that's my worry. But if that's your spot, like the argument for folding is obvious, and you were there and I weren't, so I'm going to trust you here.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, I did fold rightly or wrongly. Yeah. Us from the 1200-2400 level. I raise in middle position with ace deuce 6-9. I believe I made it 5500 with the open. Okay. What do you think about opening this in middle position if I don't have a suit?
If you don't have a good chance of taking the blinds down, then I would rather just fold.
I thought that I did, actually.
Yeah, then it's fine. It's just a standard semi-bluff. But this hand sucks. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it's not very good. I mean, you got some things going on, and having the initiative will help a little bit. But it's not a good hand.
Yeah, so. I may have fallen a little too much into a like trying to steal the blinds sort of mentality, which is a lot less important in a game that doesn't have antes. You know, like late game in a No Limit tournament, certainly, but you're really putting a premium on stealing blinds, a little less important when there aren't antes out there. So I open with the ace deuce 6-9, and I'm called by the cutoff. We go heads up, and we see a 10-5-3 rainbow flop. So I've now flopped the nut low draw and a gut shot, and that's about it in terms of high capabilities.
Yeah, that sucks.
And this is why a hand like this is not so great to be playing from middle position.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to sound too obvious to even state, but imagine you're playing Pot Limit Omaha and you pick up ace deuce 6-9. That's a sucky hand you would never play. So yeah, the fact that you have you're going to make the nut low sometime is partially redemptive, but really only partially. And this spot is why it's really nice to have. You know, even if you get counterfeited, you still have the second nut low to fall back on. So that's cool. So there's 55, 11, you know, like 14 in the pot, something like that. 14K. 14-6. Yeah, and he's got 41K, and you cover 14-6 in the pot.
So about a 3-to-1 SPR.
Yeah. Any reads on the opponent here?
No, I don't remember if I did. I didn't record them, so probably not.
So this is a spot where you can consider a check raise, because even with just the gut shot and like the 9 is going to be good sometimes, ridiculously enough, and things like that, you might have too much equity where if you get all in, you don't like it, but you still have to be all in. So a check raise can be considered. The main bad thing about the check raise is on the 10-5-3. If you think about the hands that he's calling with the 4-4 the flop, the ones that can bet that flop, a lot of them have enough to continue. Like they've got a straight draw and a pair for high and a low draw for low. But even so, if you think you can get a fold sometime, like if you think he's going to bluff all of his bad hands if you check, or even a lot of his bad hands, then check raising and getting it in nauseatedly is the play, I think. If that's not the case, then I think you have to bet and just evaluate if he raises.
That's what I did. I bet 7,000, which is about half the pot, and he potted it.
Yeah, and that's effectively close to all in, yes? Like after he calls a 7?
Yeah, I don't think he's folding ever, so.
Well, it's 28 more, so he's betting like 35 of his 41, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it sucks. But what I just said, you know, I mean, if you play it this way, I think you have to get it in and hate it. This isn't the spot you want. And if you knew he was going to raise, then you would not pursue this line, but you do have a gutter and you do have some high value. Would you mind, is it terrible radio or audio if I hop over to two dimes here real quick?
No, go for it.
All right, so ace, deuce, 6-9. And then, you know, let's say you get it in against ace, 3-4-5. Well, I guess, put yourself in a bad situation. Like, I guess ace, deuce, 4 is bad. Like, what about ace, king, deuce, 4, something like that? Then you have, like, 31%, and that's pretty bad. And then if you give him, say, top pair to go along with it, then you have 23%. But there are going to be other situations where you're better off. So I think, even though you hate it, I think just on the pot odds, you have to commit to this hand. That said, if you think he's a little bit of a tighter raiser than usual, and if you're going to have a playing edge going forward, and if you think that the bet has other merits besides that, then I can see the argument for bet folding. Once you get raised, you're in a crappy place. And that's not always, this is something we talked about on the podcast many times, the fact that you don't like getting raised is not a reason never to bet. You know, sometimes you just have to make the right play and accept being in the bad spot. And so if betting the flop is the right play, and it might be, then you just have to accept that you're going to fold some equity sometimes. And if he's anything like a loose raiser and capable of making any semi-bluffs, then if you fold, you are losing chip equity. I think you have to be very clear about that. Like, you probably have the pot odds to get all in with him in most situations, unless he's very tight. So given that, I trust your ability to make a good folding decision if you did. And you did, right?
I did. So hopefully it was a good one.
Yeah. And again, that's just why this hand is so bad. Like, you flop just enough equity. And what do you, I mean, even so, like, even knowing that you get put in this bad spot, do you still want to not bet? Like, well, checking's got its own problems. You know, just playing out of position is bad, and playing bad hands is bad. So that's that.
Okay. So last one that I wanted to talk about here. We are at the 3K, 6K level. A tight passive player in the small blind. So it folds all the way around to the player in the small blind. He's a tight passive guy. We've been talking a little bit, so we're a little bit on friendly terms. He opens for a pot, which in a blind versus blind spot means he opens for 18K. And I call with a deuce 5-6-7 double suited. Yeah. Seems like a okay preflop call.
Oh, yeah. You got position. What are the stacks?
I don't recall.
Can I offer? So is this a failure of note-taking or of... You seem not to have many reads on your opponents.
Yeah, it's a failure here. Of note-taking.
Okay, good.
That's like, right. I gave you a read on this opponent. I just didn't give you a stack.
Yes, tight. Yes, very good. Very good. Okay, fine. Yeah, it's it's good. So he opens to 18K. Let's say that you're medium deep. Say the stacks are 60K again. Oh, no. Let's say the stacks are 70K or 80K.
80 is probably a good number to count on.
So, yeah, deuce 5-6-7. You got some, you know, you're double suited. You've got straight and flush potential. You've got position, which is great. He doesn't have to. I mean, even tight passive players understand that sometimes if you only have one opponent, you can bet and they'll fold and you win the pot. Like, that's not, you know. That's fine. Yeah. So I like the call. So there's 36K in the pot. Let's say there's 70K behind or something. I don't know. Or more. 80K?
Probably less. I think 80 before the raise. So like 62K behind when we see the flop.
Okay. So SPR of like 2?
Less than 2. King, queen, jack with a flush draw.
King, queen, jack with a flush draw for you.
I believe it was 7 high, but I don't think it matters terribly much whether it was 7 or 6 or 5 high.
No. So he checks. I think you got to bet this. Bet folding is not so bad because if he's raising... He's probably got a lot. Like, if he's tight passive, if he raises full pot, then check raises you, a lot of times you're going to be looking at ace-ace-10 or ace-10 of some other kind or a set that he's going with or some other hand that he, yeah. And a lot of his raising hands, like, and a lot of these tight passive players would have called with high cards. So I think on this flop, I would fake commit. I think I would probably bet, like 26 or something.
Make it look like I'm not going anywhere and then actually fold if he shoves.
Yeah, exactly. And then he might just, yeah. Because, like, what's he going to, this is also something else we talk about. Like, he doesn't have to plan to fold. Like, let's say he has two aces that he opened with, and then he checks and you bet big. Like, what's he going to do? Yeah, I mean, like, does he really want to be, like, the idiot who busted with two aces? I mean, everybody know, you know, like, everybody's going to make fun of him as he walks away. Like, it looks, you know, you can take a flop with a lot of hands. You know, it's not that hard to have 10-9 in your hand or ace-10 or something like that. And you can plausibly represent the nuts, given that there's a flush draw. Like you have good reason to bet the nuts heavily. Namely, it's a tournament, and... People really like to protect their hands in tournaments sometimes. And also, there's a flush draw on board. So I think I would fake commit here, whatever that meant.
Are you more or less likely to do that when you have a flush draw?
It depends on the player. I'm saying that a lot today. A benefit of doing it without the flush draw is that
you mind getting raised.
Your situation is very Your situation is very clear. You're not folding away equity if you get raised. I mean, you have seven high, nothing, and you just cannot possibly win. Although, you know, I played enough PL08 that awesome things happen sometimes where I would do that and then get called by like deuce 3, 4, 5 with a five high flush draw. Or it's going to sound crazy, yeah. But like, you know, when you win with like eight high in a pot with some post-flop action in PL08, it feels wonderful. Yeah, I still smile when I do. Yeah. You know, you like take screenshots and you send around to all your friends, at least if you're me. Yeah. Then the benefit of having a flush draw is that if he decides to get stubborn and call, like even with, you know, aces or ace king or aces with a nut flush draw or something like that, although he might just bet and commit with that, then you can still make a flush and win and maybe even make a good value bet on the end. So I think I'm probably pretty likely to do it either way. Maybe a little bit more likely to do it with a flush draw.
And I think especially
because he would bet a lot of flush draws.
Yeah, given that he's loose passive especially, I think...
Tight passive.
Sorry, yeah, against a tight passive player especially, I think betting with the flush draw better because he might just check call with some hands that other people would check raise. Yeah. Like the more aggressive the player is, the more you might be concerned about not wanting to get raised off of your equity. And the more passive he is, the more you can think that you don't have so much equity when he raises.
Yeah.
Like better flush draws... You know, they go along with a pair or something like that are easily in his check raising range. It's not like you're folding nine clean outs here.
You know, a tight passive player, I think if he had a lot, tight guys who make hands bet when they make hands, you know? He might check ace 10 with backup spades. Like if he had the nuts with a nut redraw, then that's a check probably. But not even all the time. And I think a lot of his best hands will be betting here. So I would try to win this pot. Another thing you can do is to bet small and figure you won't get raised and then judge his reaction. Then bet bigger on the next street. And then yeah, that has the benefit of getting also his flop call. So you could go like bet 12K, then bet half the pot on the next street. And this is, again, things that are even more matters of feel. So I would have to know the opponent better.
So I mentioned before that someone scolded me on Twitter for taking too long. And I think that this was the main hand that prompted that. I tanked for a really long time on the flop, mostly just trying to make, like, this is an example of my being inexperienced in PLOE where I kind of had to start from scratch here and think to myself, okay, what kind of hands does it make sense for him to check on this flop? And, you know, what would he be check calling? What would he be check folding? And I kind of thought this was a flop that he was pretty likely to bluff if he had nothing. Even as a, like, he's tight passive, but he's not terrible. I mean, as you said, he gets that. If when there's only one person left,
yeah,
you know, neither player probably has a strong hand, and you want to try to win the pot. And I mean, like blind versus blind, my range for calling out of the big blind is pretty wide. I'm a lot more likely to be playing high card hands than I would be if I had, you know, he'd raised an early position and I had called an early position or something. This just becomes a harder and harder board for someone to hit if they're playing an early position because they're so much more likely to be playing low hands. So it's not necessarily like a board that I'm guaranteed to whiff or anything, but I kind of thought if he had a hand similar to mine or like the ace, deuce, 4, 5 that you optimistically mentioned, check calling here, I think that pretty likely to take a stab at it. I really thought that a check here probably indicated some showdown value on his part. I think your point is interesting where he might be check deciding or he might be checking without realizing that he's going to decide. But if I make a committing looking bet, then he would end up folding it. So I tanked for a long time before checking. Given that I did check the flop, would you be trying to bluff when a three turns if he checks you again? And just, for those who don't remember my hand, it's deuce 5, 6, 7. So I still don't have a pair. The three did not pair me.
So I think I wouldn't check the three on the turn, partly because you wouldn't mind seeing if you make your flush. And also, it really looks like you don't have anything. Like, why are you betting the turn if you didn't bet the flop? Yeah. Like, it looks like your hand looks a lot like, you know, like ace 3, 7, 8. That, like, ooh, I can win if I bet. I don't know. I would rather check behind on the turn.
Okay, good. So I tanked for probably 30% less long than I tanked on the flop. And then I checked behind on the turn. The river brings another jack, and I still don't have a flush, so I'm still sitting here on 7 high. He checks again on the river.
Yeah, would check.
You wouldn't try to fire at this point?
No, I don't think so.
So do you just not have a bluffing range at all by the time we get to the river like this?
Yeah, probably not. probably not. I think he's going to check call with too many of his hands.
You really can't represent anything but a jack when you bet the river.
I was going to say, like, if you bet, like, it's because jacks are pretty plausible, you know, for you.
I think I tanked even longer on the river than I did on the flop, trying to decide whether or not I should try to represent a jack on this board, and whether I.
And given that you tanked, I might bet. I don't know. It's like, bluffing?
The longer I tanked, the more I was like, so have I turned this into a good bluffing spot by tanking for so long?
Yeah. Although, like, maybe by that point he's so annoyed at you that he's going to spike call you. It's very tricky. Like, yeah, it's tough. I think in the heat of the moment, if I got there that way, I would probably check. But I see some arguments for betting.
Yeah, I did end up checking, and he had aces, and he told me that he was not intending on folding at any point.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what he said. People say that. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I still think betting the flop is a good play in that spot, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm talking about what worked in 2008. I don't know. I
mean, who knows what he's going to do in the moment, but yeah, I mean, I think someone else, possibly the person who later scolded me on Twitter, asked, like, what was the result of that hand or something, because he had given up on paying attention, and the guy said something along the lines of, I won it with aces, and he finally figured out that I wasn't going to fold, or something like that.
Congratulations again on the run. It got you, two-thirds unstuck on your prelims, something like that?
More like 50%.
All right, you got halfway unstuck. Way to go.
Well, I guess that's before I count the money that I made off of markup.
Yeah. Well, you know, on a playing level. So.
Right. that's the biggest thing. It was so much fun. You know, I think I had a lot more fun getting deep in this event than I would have getting deep in a no-limit event. Because a no-limit event, I'm still, like, it's going to feel more like situations I've been in over and over and over again. And so this was a lot of fun, partly because I didn't feel too outclassed. I felt like I was playing short stack PL08 nearly as well, like better than a lot of people, and nearly as well as a lot of other people. Like, even people who were clearly a lot better at PL08 generically, or just, you know, better players or better tournament players or whatever generically than I am, I didn't feel like they had huge edges on me playing specifically short stacked PL08. And and I felt like there were some people. I mean, the most comic hand that I saw, and you and I have talked about this one already, but I think it's worth sharing with everyone else, because you and I had a chat during the dinner break. We talked a bit about what my strategy ought to be for playing short stacked, and at that time I had what in retrospect might have been some kind of tough table draws with like 6 and 5 and 4 tables remaining. I had a lot of really good people. I mentioned Doc Sands here, who maybe not a PL08 expert, but clearly a fantastic player. I played with a couple of other, like, you know, real mixed game aces. I played with the guy who wrote the 08 chapter for Super System, Mark Gregoric, I'm not sure how he pronounces it. I played with Barry Greenstein. I played with Alan Cunningham. I just, you know, I played with a lot of really top players. And so I said to you on break, I was like, I don't know. I mean, with 3 tables remaining, I don't know that I'm really in the top 9 in terms of skill, like that I can expect to, that if we had equal stacks, that I would expect that I was a favorite to make the final table or something like that. Yeah. I was kind of like, I don't know that I'm really looking to preserve a skill edge at this point. Once we got down to 2 tables, I was moved, or maybe it was even with 3 tables, I was moved and sat with 2 people who had huge stacks and no idea how to play PL08. So the most comical hand that I saw started with the under the gun player raising something like 2.5 big blinds, and he has a massive stack. He had like maybe 600k at this level, which is like 100 big blinds. I'm at a point where I had 80k, and the average stack was maybe 200. This guy had 600k. So he opens under the gun, and then the player on the button, who also has a big stack, he's got like 400k and is covered only by the player under the gun. He pots it, and under the gun calls, and we get a...
Blinds 5k, 10k. This is Andrew speaking here in my email inbox. Guy to my left opens to 25,000 under the gun. It folds to a gentleman on the button who pots it to 90,000. And it's called. 25k, 90k, call. Flop jack, 9-5. Check, button pots. Other guy tanks and folds kings face up. And the button also shows kings.
Yeah, so There's an outside chance that Button's 3-bet was good. You know, maybe if he has like ace, deuce, king, king, you could justify 3-betting that. Although even then, I don't think you'd want to do it against the only player at the table who has you covered.
Yeah.
You just shouldn't be trying to play big pots against him. And he's an under the gun raiser. I really think you wanted to be calling even with like ace, deuce, king, king.
Yeah. I mean, I do think if you think that you're going to get a fold before the flop a lot of the time, then as in no limit, like,
yeah, go ahead. It seems unlikely to me though.
Yeah, sure. Me too. I mean, I would just fold with most of my king's hands there, but
pretty unlikely it was a good idea to 3-bet. And likewise, I think for under the gun holding kings, unless he has extremely good kings, like ace deuce king king or an ace three king king kind of hand, he should be folding the kings when he opens under the gun and gets potted by a guy who can do a lot of damage to him, because aces is going to be a big part of that guy's range.
Yeah, and if he does have a good king's hand, even a poor erratic player is going to give you some trouble after the flop, and you should probably like get it in before the flop if you're not like crazy deep. Yeah, probably there are a lot of his king's hands should have either folded or 4-bet.
And then after that, I'm also not sure that I like, or actually I'm pretty sure that I don't like the Button potting the Jack 9x flop, which is at that point it's about half of the effective stacks when he pots it there. And I really don't think he's getting action from worse. I mean, he might feel like kings is a pretty good hand there, which I think you'd be wrong about, but he's not. I mean, if he gets action there after potting it and if he has bare kings, which he claimed he didn't, so I'm thinking maybe he had a hand like a king king queen 10 or something, which I don't think is at all a good 3-bet against the under the gun raiser. That's the sort of hand that you'd be willing to get all in with on the flop, but I still don't know that you'd want to pot it to do that.
I agree with that. I mean, as always, there are a lot of situational things that could change any of this, but it's very, very likely, especially given that they showed the hands, that there are a lot of bad things going on.
And then like the under gun is tanking for a while before he folds the flop, as though he's like seriously considering that maybe he should be going with kings here.
So you had the tough table with three tables left, is what
you're saying. Yeah, and once we got down to two, I was like, oh, maybe I have a skill edge here after all.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, I can't wait to be out in Vegas. We can maybe record a podcast live. You know what we have next week? We have a guest next week. This is going to be great.
a what?
G-U-E-S-T.
Oh, yeah, we used to have those. They were fun.
Yeah. It's great. So we have an exciting guest next week. And
although I think, and I'm curious to know what our listeners think about this, but there was a lot of excitement when I announced on Twitter, kind of by way of apologizing that this episode was coming out late, I announced that we're going to be doing a PLO8 episode, and there was a lot of excitement about that. I think it would be fun. Unfortunately, just with the WSOP going on, it's really been tough to line up guests this month, and as cool as it would have been to bring in someone who knew more about PLO8 than Nate or I did, just didn't prove possible for this episode. I think it'd be cool to do an encore, either with a focus on PLO8 or maybe just focus on PLO or on 08 if we wanted to switch it a little bit and try to get a guest in on that in the not too distant future. So curious to hear what you and the audience think about that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And just more generally, we've got a bit of flexibility going forward. And so first, we apologize for some late episodes. Andrew's been traveling. I've been getting ready for Vegas. Yeah, it's just this is a trickier time to coordinate everybody's schedule. And like the people who we want to bring on and interview are also in Vegas and playing 25 tournaments. And it's tricky. So we apologize and we thank you. And also, but there's a good side to all of this, which is that the same things that are making it hard for us to release episodes on time are also making other things possible. For example, I can go play some mixed games, then we can talk about them on the air. I probably am going to play some mixed games while I'm there. And all sorts of things for the podcast are possible. So if you have an idea or if there's a game or that you want us to talk about or somebody that you think we could catch up with while we're in Vegas, this is a good time to suggest things for the podcast. Many things are possible that are not usually
and,
possible.
And last thing, while we're thanking people, I think we should give a shout out to Gareth, who many of you know from his frequent appearances on the show. You may or may not know that he's been doing the editing on the show for the last couple of months, and I think doing a pretty great job of it. If you think the show sounds good, if you think it's well cut together and not a lot of time is wasted and you're not hearing a lot of ums and uhs and sorry Gareths, and our volumes are relatively close to each other, if you think all of that has been sounding good, you have Gareth to thank for it. And unfortunately, this is going to be the final episode that he's editing for us, so I think it's worth, we were paying him a little something, but not nearly what he was worth, so I'm not too surprised that he's moving on to greener pastures, and I think it's worth giving giving him a hearty thanks for working below market value for as long as he did. Big thank you, Gareth.
Yeah. No, definitely big thanks to Gareth. And I'm really happy that although we have to say goodbye to him as an editor, we're not going to say goodbye to him as a friend of the podcast and occasional guest and blog commenter and just a big part of the Happy Thinking Poker
family. I can't wait to see which dictatorship he tries to topple next.
He's a champ. So with that, you know, comment on the blog. Tell us what you want. Tell us what you think. And we're sorry again. But we do have good episodes coming up. And we hope you have a good week. Wait, I'll show you all you need to know.